Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Current area of responsibility reporting indicates escalating kinetic exchanges and maritime disruptions in the Middle East, threatening regional stability. Simultaneously, Ukrainian intermediate and long-range strike capabilities are significantly degrading Russian operational logistics and domestic air defense networks. In the Indo-Pacific, regional actors are accelerating defense cooperation to counter PRC maritime coercion, while the PRC reportedly expanded its direct military support to Iran.
So, when you really step back and look at those developments, it's pretty staggering. I mean, we're talking about a modern superpower having to ration gasoline to its own occupation forces through a smartphone app. And then, at the exact same time, you have an unrecognized maritime toll booth running on cryptocurrency and bartered goods in the Middle East. Today, we are taking you through a comprehensive deep dive into factual, sourced intelligence summaries. We're covering four key domains to give you a complete operational picture.
Yeah, and we really need to connect those dots. We're going beyond just the headlines to understand exactly how these tactical shifts are happening, you know, on the ground, in the air, and at sea.
Exactly. So let's jump right into the Middle East AOR, because there's this incredible intersection right now between traditional combat and brand new maritime technology. I was looking at the Stars and Stripes report from June 9th, 2026, and they flagged a U.S. Army AH-64 Apache helicopter crash. This was near the Strait of Hormuz on June 8th. Both crew members were rescued, which is obviously great news, but the way they were rescued is just, it's operationally fascinating. Can we unpack that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because the mechanism of that rescue is a really profound indicator of where military technology is heading. Mm-hmm. The crew wasn't picked up by another helicopter or, you know, a traditional Coast Guard cutter.
Right.
They were retrieved by an unmanned surface vessel, literally a drone boat.
Uh-huh.
This asset is operated by the Navy's Task Force 59. And what makes this historically significant is that it marks the very first drone-assisted rescue for this specific task force.
Wait, I want to make sure I understand the mechanics here. An Apache is a heavily armed attack helicopter. If it goes down in the water, getting the crew out fast is critical. How does a drone boat actually conduct search and rescue?
Yeah, it's a combination of autonomy and remote operation.
Are there just operators halfway across the world steering it with a joystick?
Well, sort of, but it's more advanced than that.
Right.
Task Force 59 was specifically stood up by CANCOM to integrate artificial intelligence and unmanned systems into fleet operations. These vessels, they have arrays of optical and thermal sensors.
Wow.
So they can autonomously navigate to a designated distress coordinate, scan the water to locate the crew, and then position themselves for the pilots to climb aboard, all while feeding real-time video and data back to a human command center. It essentially removes the risk of sending a manned crew into a potentially hazardous environment.
And, I mean, that environment is incredibly hostile right now. U.S. forces are actively maintaining a blockade on Iranian ports. The latest situational update from the Institute for the Study of War, or ISW, this covers June 5th through the 8th, they noted that CNTCOM had to physically enforce this blockade on June 8th.
Yeah, they disabled the Palo-flagged tanker MT Merivex.
Right, when it tried to breach the cordon. But while the U.S. is enforcing this blockade, Iran is basically setting up a competing reality. They are attempting to enforce their own completely unrecognized, completely illegal traffic separation scheme right in the Strait of Hormuz.
Exactly. They're attempting to establish a parallel maritime authority in one of the world's most critical naval choke points. And the ISW reporting details exactly how they're doing it. Ships attempting to transit through Iran's scheme are being charged massive transit fees.
How massive are we talking?
We're talking an average of $1.5 to $2 million per ship.
Okay, I am stuck on the logistics of this. So we're looking at a modern maritime toll booth operating on the high seas. How are they collecting $2 million without international banks immediately freezing the funds?
That is where the strategy gets incredibly cunning. The ISW notes that Iran is extracting these payments in the form of cryptocurrency.
Wow. And physical bartered goods, right?
Yes. By demanding crypto, they entirely bypass the SWIFT banking system. They bypass all the traditional financial networks that monitor and enforce global sanctions.
So you literally have international shipping conglomerates, or maybe their shell companies, wiring Bitcoin just to avoid being boarded by the Iranian Navy.
Precisely. or handing over shipping containers full of unregulated goods. And this localized maritime tension, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. It is the economic engine attached to a rapid regional escalation cycle on land.
Right, the multi-front pressure.
Yeah. The ISW maps out a very specific chain of events from early June. First, you have Hezbollah firing rockets into northern Israel. Second, Israel retaliates by striking a Hezbollah headquarters in Beirut.
And then Iran responds directly.
Exactly. Iran fired a barrage of roughly 10 missiles at Israel's Ramat David Air Base, though the reporting indicates Israeli air defenses intercepted all of them. And finally, Israel subsequently struck Iranian air defense and drone manufacturing sites deep inside the Tehran and Esfahan provinces.
So we are moving entirely from proxy skirmishes to direct state-on-state missile volleys?
Yes. And the intelligence suggests there is a calculated diplomatic strategy behind these volleys. The ISW flags a developing claim that Iran is attempting to establish what they are calling a new security equation.
A new security equation. What does that mean operationally?
They are explicitly linking the survival of their proxy, Hezbollah, to direct Iranian military responses. The assessment is that Iran is using this newly declared doctrine as leverage to stall U.S.-Iran nuclear negotiations.
Ah!
They are effectively saying, we will not discuss our nuclear program until our demands regarding Lebanon are met.
It's essentially a geopolitical hostage situation. And just to compound that, the ISW reporting notes the Houthis in Yemen have announced a complete ban on Israeli shipping in the Red Sea. They're simultaneously launching ballistic missiles towards central Israel.
It's a masterclass in asymmetric warfare.
It really is. They're using proxies and drones to stretch traditional military power to its breaking point. Which actually brings me to a fascinating parallel, because that idea of a smaller force using asymmetric tactics to bypass traditional power, it isn't just happening in the Middle East. We're seeing the exact same dynamic deep inside the Russian Federation right now.
We are. The ISW reporting covering June 6th through the 8th give an in-depth look at this. Ukrainian forces are sustaining a highly effective campaign of intermediate and long-range strikes against Russian infrastructure.
Yeah.
And the most prominent example from this reporting period happened in St. Petersburg, exactly as the city was hosting the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, or SPIEF.
I cannot overstate how wild that timing is. I mean, SPIEF is essentially Russia's Davos. It's meticulously designed by the Kremlin to project economic strength and domestic stability to international investors.
Right.
And right as the VIPs are arriving, Ukraine conducts two series of strikes against the city, hitting the Kronstadt naval base and various local oil depots.
It's a profound piercing of the information bubble. When foreign dignitaries can physically see or hear the impacts on a naval base from their conference centers, it systematically dismantles the Kremlin's messaging. More importantly, from an operational standpoint, it exposes severe vulnerabilities in Russia's domestic air defense network. If a drone can penetrate hundreds of kilometers to hit a naval base in the president's hometown during an international summit, the air defense umbrella is highly porous.
And looking at the broader target list, it's incredibly methodical. The ISW notes that beyond St. Petersburg, Ukrainian strikes successfully targeted the Grushevaya oil terminal near Novorossiysk and multiple oil depots in the Krasnodar Krai region.
They also hit the Protasovo airfield near Ryazan.
Right. That airfield is a known drone development center located roughly 470 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. They are systematically dismantling Russia's energy revenue and their drone capabilities. But the intelligence also flags an incident that shows just how high the risk tolerance has become on the other side.
Yes. While Ukraine is targeting logistics, Russian forces are demonstrating a willingness to engage in very high-risk targeting parameters. The ISW flagged a specific Russian drone strike on a nuclear waste storage facility. This was located near the Kornobyl nuclear power plant in the Kyiv Oblast.
Wait, they actually struck a nuclear waste facility.
They did. Now, the crucial factual detail provided by the intelligence is that no spent nuclear fuel was present at the facility during the strike.
Okay, well, that's a relief.
It is, but the operational takeaway here isn't the physical damage. It's the sheer risk tolerance. Launching kinetic strikes into the immediate vicinity of Kornobyl highlights a brazen disregard for the potential of radiological contamination.
Yeah, it only takes one navigational error in a sector like that to trigger a catastrophe. It's incredibly reckless. But, you know, the ultimate question with all these deep strikes is whether they actually translate to movement on the front lines.
Right.
According to the Ukrainian defense source Militarny, which was cited in the ISW report, Ukrainian forces liberated approximately 250 square kilometers of territory in May 2026. During that exact same time frame, Russian forces seized 130 square kilometers. So you have Ukraine making a net gain in territory while simultaneously conducting these deep strikes.
And those two metrics are deeply connected. The strategic deep strikes into the Russian rear are not just PR stunts. They are generating acute, compounding tactical effects on the ground. They're designed to degrade the logistics networks that make Russian frontline combat operations possible.
In military speak, they call these networks GLOCs, right? Ground lines of communication.
Exactly.
But really, we're just talking about the fundamental road and rail arteries that keep an army fed and armed. If you apply a tourniquet to those arteries, the extremities eventually die. And the ISW reporting from June 6th to 8th provides some incredible indicators of this degradation playing out in occupied Crimea and Kherson.
Yes. Ukrainian intermediate strikes are consistently destroying those GLOCs, specifically targeting the MO4 and M14 highways.
Yes.
By cratering these massive logistics arteries, they're forcing Russian military transport units to abandon the highways.
Right. They have to try to navigate local coastal dirt roads. We're even seeing verified reports of Russian military trucks being painted and disguised as civilian cargo vehicles.
Yeah.
Just to avoid being targeted by Ukrainian drones. Which brings me to what I think is the most staggering detail in the entire intelligence packet.
The fuel shortages.
Yes. The effects of severing these arteries are now hitting the occupation authorities in ways they just can't hide anymore. In occupied Crimea, the degradation of the supply lines has caused such a severe gasoline shortage that authorities restricted gas sales to just 20 liters per week for individuals.
And the enforcement mechanism is what really highlights the desperation there. To get your 20 liters of gas, you have to present a QR code that is strictly distributed via a Russian state messenger app.
Just think about that for a second. Russia, literally one of the largest oil and gas producers on the planet, is having to ration gasoline to its occupation forces via a smartphone app. That is a massive flashing red indicator that their supply chain is collapsing.
It really is.
And it's not just fuel. The intelligence shows shortages of basic food supplies like buckwheat, sugar, and rice are now emerging across the peninsula.
It is the mathematical result of concurrent transit disruption. The ISW notes that Ukrainian strikes successfully damaged the Chanhar Bridge, which acts as a vital geographic choke point into Crimea.
Right.
Furthermore, a separate strike damaged a locomotive actively moving along the Moscow-Simferopol rail line. The damage was so significant that occupation authorities were prompted to completely halt passenger rail service into Crimea.
Wow. So when you disrupt both the heavy road infrastructure and the rail network simultaneously, the logistical bottleneck just becomes insurmountable for a mechanized army.
And we're seeing the tactical result of that bottleneck in real time. The ISW flagged a developing report from the Atesh Partisan Group. They're stating that the Russian 337th Airborne Regiment is actively withdrawing from the Kinburn Spit in the Mykolaiv Oblast.
And the specific reasons cited for that retreat?
The complete disruption of their supplies and their inability to repel Ukrainian drone strikes. The extremities are dying because the tourniquet on the arteries is working perfectly.
It's a textbook example of logistical starvation. But, you know, as we analyze these technological shifts, the use of drones, the vulnerability of supply chains, we really have to zoom out. Systemic military competition today isn't regional. It involves global technology transfers.
Right, and coalition building.
Exactly. And moving into the Indo-Pacific AOR, we are seeing dynamics that directly intersect with the exact military developments we just briefed regarding the Middle East and Europe. The cross-AOR intelligence here is absolutely vital.
It is. We are looking at reported direct transfers of People's Republic of China hardware to Iran. According to the ISW report from June 5th, the PRC reportedly provided Iran with a YLC-8B long-range anti-stealth radar.
And much more aggressively, they provided MANPADS, man-portable air defense systems. These are shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles.
And the operational implications of that transfer are severe. Crucially, the ISW cites that these specific Chinese-made MANPADS were probably used to shoot down a U.S. F-15 fighter jet over Iran earlier this year on April 3rd.
Wait, I have to stop you there. Because the PRC explicitly claims that they are a neutral party that does not fan the flames of conflict.
Which is why this intelligence is so significant. Providing lethal anti-aircraft systems to Iran systems that are then utilized to down an American aircraft directly contradicts Beijing's publicly stated arms export policies.
Yeah.
Furthermore, depending on the exact dates of transfer and the mechanisms used, it potentially violates United Nations Security Council sanctions regarding conventional arms transfers to Iran. It demonstrates that the PRC is willing to covertly arm adversaries to degrade American operational freedom.
And because of these broader systemic pressures from the PRC, we're seeing regional defense coalitions in the Indo-Pacific evolving at a breakneck pace. Japan and the Philippines aren't just holding summits anymore. They are elevating their relations to a comprehensive strategic partnership.
Yeah.
The ISW notes this partnership includes accelerating the physical transfer of Japanese Abukuma-class destroyers and Type 88 anti-ship missiles directly to the Philippines.
It is a rapid militarization of the alliance. And alongside the hardware transfer, Japan and the Philippines are actively working to delimit their overlapping exclusive economic zones, or EEZs. By resolving their own maritime borders, they present a unified legal and military front against the PRC's expansive territorial claims in the region.
But it's not just about ships and missiles. It's about surviving the invisible war. We've talked about how crucial drones are in Ukraine and the Middle East. Well, in the Indo-Pacific, Taiwan's Aerospace Industrial Development Corporation, or ADC, has successfully developed a system called AISVNAV.
Mm-hmm.
The ISW reported on June 5th that this is a drone navigation system that uses visual navigation and satellite 3D mapping to operate completely independently of GPS.
Can you give us an ELI 5? Explain it like I'm 5 on how visual navigation actually works when the GPS goes dark.
Sure. Imagine you're driving a car and your GPS navigation suddenly cuts out. If you don't know the area, you're lost.
But if you have memorized the exact shape of every building, mountain, and intersection on your route, you can just look out the window, compare what you see to your memory, and know exactly where you are.
Oh, I see.
AISVNAV does exactly that, but at machine speed. It has an onboard database of highly detailed 3D satellite maps. The drone uses its own cameras to look at the ground in real time, feeds that video into an onboard AI, and the AI matches the video feed to the 3D map.
So it literally navigates by sight, completely ignoring the satellites. Why is that specific capability so urgent in the Indo-Pacific right now?
Because the expected operational environment will be saturated with electronic warfare. If your drone relies on a faint GPS signal from space, an adversary can easily jam it by blasting localized radio noise, rendering the drone blind and useless.
Oh, okay.
By navigating visually via onboard AI, the drone bypasses the electromagnetic spectrum entirely. It is a critical capability for platform survivability against an adversary like the People's Liberation Army, or PLA, which heavily integrates electronic warfare into its tactics.
And we know the PLA is actively flexing those electronic warfare muscles right now. The ISW notes that the PLA just utilized electronic jamming as a non-kinetic countermeasure against the Dutch Navy frigate De Ruyter. This was while the ship was conducting a freedom of navigation operation in the South China Sea.
Yeah, they are actively testing their ability to blind Allied sensors.
Wow.
And beyond the tactical use of electronic warfare at sea, the PRC is making massive strategic posture shifts on land. Satellite imagery cited by the ISW on June 5th reveals that the PRC is actively expanding its land-based nuclear launch infrastructure in the Xinjiang region.
Right.
The intelligence assesses that the objective of this expansion is to distribute their silos and increase the survivability of their nuclear arsenal against any potential first strikes. It fundamentally alters the strategic nuclear calculus in the region.
It is incredible how all these seemingly isolated events weave together. To summarize the operational significance of what we've covered today, we are observing highly interconnected theaters. In the Middle East, Iran is attempting to establish new security equations and illegal maritime toll booths, prompting direct escalation and U.S. interdiction, including the first drone-assisted rescues.
Exactly.
In Europe, Ukraine's strategic strike campaign into the Russian deep rear is systematically degrading Russian logistics and air defense. It's creating measurable tactical withdrawals and absurd rationing scenarios, like needing a QR code for gas in occupied Crimea.
Yeah.
And in the Indo-Pacific, the proliferation of Chinese hardware to Iran, coupled with intense electronic warfare, is driving rapid coalition building and incredible technological innovation, like GCODIS denied visual navigation among regional actors.
The overarching takeaway from this intelligence is that the isolation between these theaters is rapidly decreasing. When you see advanced radar and missile hardware transferring from the PRC to Iran, and the tactical lessons of drone warfare moving from the Black Sea to the Taiwan Strait, it demonstrates a globally integrated operational landscape. Analysts can no longer look at these AORs in silos.
To conclude this briefing, I want you to consider how the rapid proliferation of autonomous and unmanned systems is simultaneously reshaping tactical engagements across all three AORs. We went from a drone-assisted search and rescue in the Strait of Hormuz to logistics interdiction in occupied Ukraine to the urgent development of GPS-denied navigation systems in the Indo-Pacific.
The machines are no longer just tools. They are the connective tissue of modern systemic competition. Thank you for joining us for this intelligence summary.
Stay informed, keep connecting the dots, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.